This week in the news, blowback against a Republican gun control proposal, also a lawsuit over chicken, and a big announcement in the race for U.S. Senate. In our interview, we talk with Travis County GOP Chair Matt Makowiak about how citizens in Austin are fighting back as the mayor takes his cues on homeless policy from San Francisco. And we close with a commentary from Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan. Coming to you from the 1836 studios in Austin, Texas, this is Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald. You can follow me on Twitter at TweetTonyMac. You can find us on the web at www.texasscorecard.com. Now, I wanted to get started with this week's news. I've got Destin Sinski, Capitol correspondent for Texas Scorecard. Big blowback in the Capitol against Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick over this gun control proposal. NRA coming out against it, other groups coming out against it. Let's talk about that.
Right. So Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is leading the charge on Republicans in control of the Capitol, putting forward some sort of measure on the heels of these shootings. And it looks like it's going to be a gun control proposal that they're going to bring to the forefront. Some of the more conservative gun rights organizations, Second Amendment advocates, have been critical of this. But now, big dog enters the scene, the National Rifle Association, an organization that had always typically supported Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and Republican leaders in the Capitol.
They've been kind of almost docile when it comes to the Republican leadership in Texas, not very critical at all, but very outspoken.
That's right.
Against this proposal from Lieutenant Governor
Patrick.
Yeah. Tell us, what is it that he's actually proposing?
So what Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is describing as stranger-to-stranger sales, they would like to implement a policy that would bring those transfers into the background check system. So we would run background checks on private-to-private sales, which is a little bit different than the current, what we have now.
So currently you have federal firearms licensees. People who are in the business of buying and selling guns, they do a background check when they make a sale. And there's a whole system for that. Private individuals can sell to somebody. They aren't part of that system. They're not professionals who are linked in to do that. And so this proposal would say, hey, those private individuals, if they want to make a private sale to somebody, then some of those sales would have to go through a background check before they could lawfully be done. I'm confused, though, like, what is a stranger, frankly, from a legal standpoint?
Yeah, it's very vague and borderlines being unenforceable to some extent.
Yeah, it's almost like, okay, I could sell to my brother, but I can't. Can I sell to my brother's friend? If I know the guy, how long do I need to know him? Do I know him for 5 minutes? Do I know him for 5 years? And if I knew him for 5 years, does that really matter? I mean, lots of people, these people go haywire and go shoot people and stuff, and their families are going, I never expected that anything like this would happen. So it's a very confusing policy.
So now all of the Second Amendment organizations are kind of, they're all on the same side of this, and they're coming out very, very vocally against Patrick and other people's pushing this policy. But one of the people who's been kind of quiet on the heels of his roundtable discussions is Governor Greg Abbott. And former state representative of Irving, Republican Matt Rinaldi, pointed out this week that Abbott's website, Governor Greg Abbott, still has a page that says he is against this very policy. But the context is it's left up from a few years ago when the Obama administration was pushing the proposal.
Yeah, so typical partisan thing here whenever Democrats propose a gun grab, all the Republicans know, of course, that's bad. We don't want to do that. We don't want more gun regulation that criminalizes lawful gun owners. But now a Republican proposing it, will Republicans, stick with their principles and oppose that?
That's right. So Republicans, kind of moving closer to act. We've got to do something. We'll see here in the weeks ahead whether or not liberties are protected here for folks.
Appreciate your reporting on it, Dustin.
Yes, sir.
Next, let's turn to Jacob Asmussen with the Central Texas Bureau and turn our focus to San Antonio. Tell us why a group down there is suing the city.
That's right, Tony. There's a real chicken fight going down in the city right now. San Antonio is getting sued for their city council's recent decision to discriminate against Chick-fil-A.
Now, it's interesting. So a group of citizens there initiating this lawsuit, and it's under the new law passed by the legislature during the session.
That's right, Tony. And the new law prohibits local governments from discriminating against a company because of the company's private donations to religious organizations.
Now, this was inspired. People are kind of probably vaguely aware there's this fight going on between San Antonio and Chick-fil-A. So tell us a little bit about that, and then let's move from there.
Yeah, so the new state law actually was inspired by the San Antonio story, which happened back in March. The San Antonio City Council voted to ban Chick-fil-A from opening in their airport terminal because they disagreed with Chick-fil-A's owner's beliefs on marriage.
Yeah, well, and to be clear, you know, their complaint is these guys give money to radical organizations like, you know, Fellowship of Christian Athletes and Salvation Army, you know. So this group of citizens there banding together to file a lawsuit. I guess they really like chicken sandwiches.
I guess so. That's right, Tony. So city council bans Chick-fil-A. The state legislature passes a new state law. And now that the law is in effect, those citizens have filed a lawsuit against San Antonio to get them to stop discriminating.
Okay. So their goal is to force the city to drop this policy and allow Chick-fil-A to set up business, I think, at the airport, right?
That's right, Tony. And so the lawsuit's currently in the Bexar County District Court, and we'll see what happens with it.
Yeah, I was looking at this. Really interesting. One of the lawyers involved, actually former Solicitor General Jonathan Mitchell.
That's right, Tony. So there's definitely some key players in this case. There's actually an ongoing investigation into this story by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton right now as well.
Yeah, so action from the state level, and then now we're seeing action from this group of citizens there in San Antonio. Be very interesting to see how successful they are.
Absolutely.
Finally, let's turn to Brandon Walton's Capitol Bureau Chief. You traveled up to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex for a big surprise announcement in the U.S. Senate race.
Yes, the U.S. Senate race here. You've got Senator John Cornyn, of course, the incumbent, and now you've got a new entrant into the Republican primary, potentially. You had State Senator Pat Fallon, state senator from up there, serving his first term, but he's served in the state house for a while. He went out and announced that he was actually exploring a run against Cornyn for the Senate in 2020.
Yeah, and so big news. I mean, so far you'd seen Cornyn running for re-election with kind of minor challengers of any sort, not a big name, and then you had all the Democrats lining up, you know, to try and gain that nomination to challenge Cornyn. Very interesting race that's developing there. Now, tell us a little bit about where all this took place. Is that a conservative group meeting?
Yeah, the true Texas Project. A lot of folks might have heard the Northeast Tarrant Tea Party. They have recently rebranded, re-energized, just given that their reach now is kind of far beyond just Northeast Tarrant County. And so a great group of folks. That's where Fallon made this announcement, made it early on in the meeting. And, you know, you heard a lot of positive response from people, a lot of people who are really hungry for some sort of challenger to Cornyn. I mean, right now, Cornyn's race, the Senate race, is pretty much the top of the ballot as far as state races.
I mean, totally. Yeah. I mean, you're going to see, obviously, people are going to be showing up in big numbers to vote for or against President Trump, right. And that's going to dominate, you know, the election. But then the very next thing on the ballot is this race for U.S. Senate, and it's a big, important thing.
Exactly, and up until now, we really hadn't seen. You have one other candidate, Dwayne Stovall, who abandoned, and he was running as an independent, and now he's joined the Republican primary. But other than that, you didn't have any sort of serious opposition to Cornyn.
On the Republican side.
On the Republican side, yes. Meanwhile, you've got Democrats, as you pointed out. They're lining up. I mean, you have just tons of candidates from Royce West to some other folks that have lined up in that race, because Democrats really see this as a potential pickup opportunity for them in 2020.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about, give a little analysis here. There's a lot of speculation. I don't think people know the answer of who would be a stronger candidate for Republicans in 2020. Obviously, look, Cornyn comes in with the name ID. He's been around forever. He's been in office for 17 years. Typically, you know, people get frustrated with incumbents, but it's just a reality of life that incumbents do well in elections.
Well, they do. And plus, you've got analysis from some folks that would say, well, he's more moderate. He's not as conservative as maybe a lot of Republicans would like him to be. But maybe that's actually an asset in 2020 to appeal to Democrats. Of course, as we've seen that kind of argument play out. It never really seems to hold water. Democrats vote for Democrats, you know, sure, generally right. speaking.
Yeah. And they're not going to vote this guy. They're going to go, oh, this guy's, you know, horrible Republican, whatever. It doesn't really matter right. what shade of Republican they are. It's bad from a Democrat perspective.
Right. And so you have Fallon making the argument. He's essentially saying, look, we need somebody on our side to energize our base, just like Beto O'Rourke did for Democrats in 2018. And we need somebody who's going to go out there and energize Republicans to go vote in that general election. Yeah, so making the argument that he's helpful in a general
election. Yeah, and I think that you could make that case. It's really hard to tell, but I guess that's something that we'll see play out as the race goes on, assuming that Fallon does, in fact, kind of pull the trigger and make this campaign.
And we'll see. He's going to make that decision in the coming days. Already, Cornyn has the endorsements of, you know, the statewides like Abbott, Patrick, and such. But we'll see what happens in the coming days.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's my pleasure to welcome on the show this week Matt Makowiak, Travis County GOP chair, a political consultant. But the reason I've got you on this week to talk about this craziness in Austin over the homeless camping ordinance that the city has adopted or failed to adopt, or whatever we would say is happening, where we have folks just sleeping on the streets all over the place in Texas capital city. You're doing a lot to organize on that, so I wanted to bring you on to talk about it.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. So for people who are in real Texas, outside of Travis County, outside of the blue, well, we got several blue dots in the state now, but you know, outside of Austin, what's going on here? Give people a little snapshot of what's been going on over the last few months.
Yeah, so in the middle of June at a council meeting, the mayor and the city council voted 9-2 to basically end the prohibition on public camping, you know, thereby allowing homeless people to sleep and camp anywhere in public, as long as it wasn't dangerous or obstructive. They did exempt city parks, private property, and city buildings that have a curfew, which would, of course, include City Hall.
Interestingly enough, they exempted themselves from this.
Yeah, exactly. So that policy took effect July 1st. After that council meeting, they went on vacation for 5 weeks, as they always do during the month of July. And this issue just really exploded while they were gone. And so they left, you know, Austin residents and the Austin Police Department more directly to sort of clean up the mess and to deal with it. Starting July 1st, we started to see, you know, homeless people in a much more visible way, in a much more sort of combative way in some cases, with, you know, significant incidents of, you know, public safety being threatened. I don't think the council thought through the public health aspects of this. If someone is camping on a sidewalk, they don't really have a restroom to use, so it creates all kinds of problems related to that. It's been most profound in downtown, where we have hotels and restaurants and small businesses, and people are littered all over the, you know, downtown area, which is affecting the image of Austin. It's affecting conferences and business meetings and events and you name it. And so, you know, this is really just kind of boomeranged. And I think the city doesn't really know what to do. They're not good at admitting mistakes. They're not good at undoing, you know, progressive things that they decide to do. Their argument was they wanted to sort of decriminalize homeless existence, was their approach. The idea being, you know, if someone is, you know, sleeping on a bench, they could be cited and given a ticket. If they don't have money to pay the ticket, then they have a warrant for their arrest. Putting them in jail doesn't, you know, lead to getting them, you know, in a better situation and off the streets and perhaps out of homelessness altogether. And look, I mean, there's probably a fairly, I don't know, admirable instinct there, perhaps.
Well, and I think, you know, a few years ago, I was part of a discussion where we looked at the city of Louisville's arrest mm-hmm. records, and it was really interesting. You had, you know, certain repeat customers, if you will. There was one guy who had been picked up and arrested like 200 and something, you know, 250 times in a year. And so obviously, you know, picking these people up and running them, processing them through the jailhouse and then dumping them back out because it's, you know, some minor offense doesn't make sense. But so does this, you know, this alternative has been a disaster as well.
No, that's right. And that's why, you know, I mean, I think that it's first important to understand the scale of the problem in Austin, because the policy has made the problem worse. But the problem is the size of the homeless community, the fact that it's growing, and the unique problems inside that community.
Well, and we have a magnet effect that's going. I see articles and things going on about Hayes County dumping, you know, people. They'll pick up vagrants in Hayes County and then take them across the county line and dump them here in Travis County because this kind of liberal bastion on these policies.
And I just last week also heard of an incident where at least three homeless individuals were bused from Dallas here as well. So let's just kind of give some context here. So the city says we have 2,200 homeless people on any given day. We have 800 beds throughout the city, mostly through nonprofits and churches and things like that. That means we need 1,400 more beds. We spend $30 million in taxpayer money every year. The mayor has admitted our homeless policies have failed. And so, you know, they've done such a bad sequencing. It's astounding. So,
well, and what's interesting I see in Austin is, you know, even you go past the arch, people who aren't familiar with Austin, you drive past this homeless shelter that's at 7th and Red River. It's a block away from the 6th Street Entertainment District. It's a terrible location for a homeless shelter, but it's there. And what's interesting is you have all these folks, you know, day and night, all hours, outside of the shelter. They don't go in, right? And so, you know, even if you had more beds, if there's nobody saying, hey, you know, either go get services or go somewhere else, you know, you can't just be living out here on the street in front of a shelter, you know, doing drugs and other things. That's just not going to be something to tolerate.
No, you raise a good point. And the Arch is the single most dangerous block in the city of Austin. And it's, as you said, right in the heart of downtown, one block from 6th Street. It's effectively become a no-go zone. And what you have actually is you have drug dealers and sex traffickers and pimps who go to that area to prey on homeless people. So it's actually a profoundly unsafe place for homeless people.
Sure.
Not just for, you know, non-homeless people. But the sequencing here that I want to talk about just for a second is important. You know, they announced this change. They overruled the police department, the police association, the Downtown Alliance, the Greater Austin Crime Commission, all these organizations that said, don't do this. Take a couple months. Let's study this. Let's be thoughtful. Let's do it the right way. They didn't do that. They announced the policy change. They went on vacation, and they thought they were being really compassionate towards homeless people. They have now, proposed doubling the amount of money we spend on homeless policy from 30 to 62 million. And just, just this week, by the time your listeners are hearing this, you know, the city's new homeless expert will have taken office, a person who's coming from the city of Orlando. So they basically, you know, changed the policy, created a massive problem before hiring an expert, and in the midst of all of it, proposed doubling the amount of money that we're going to spend taxpayers.
Yeah, creating or at least exacerbating a problem,
right.
and then we got to throw money at that problem. Which the money isn't going to solve the problem because they're importing these policies from San Francisco, from Seattle, from these West Coast, you know, leftist bastions, and they can't solve the problem there with money. Why would we be able to solve the problem here with money?
Yeah, you know, and you raise a good point on the shelters. I mean, one of the other things that's really concerning here is the mayor has said recently that the homeless camping ordinance is going to stay in effect until we have enough housing to house our homeless population. The city is proposing a new homeless shelter in South Austin. They paid $8 million for a building valued at $2 million. It's within 1 mile of three public schools, all of which are Hispanic majority, and there has been an absolute uproar in that neighborhood. They do not want an arch-style homeless shelter. It's only going to have 100 beds, okay? So that thing's going to take a year and a half probably to get it up and running. That's just to solve 100 of the 1,400 beds that we need for homeless people. So, you know, we are talking, if the standard is the homeless camping ordinance has to stay in place until we have sufficient housing for 1,400 homeless people, we are talking years from now until that happens.
Well, yeah, so one of the things I wanted to talk with you about, obviously we've laid out a lot of the problem here, is some of the organization, you know, it's a good example of fighting back, because I feel like there is progress being made. You launched a petition just in kind of organically of a ton of signatures. So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing to organize that effort and some of the organized, citizen-driven backlash against this craziness.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So on July 17th, right, so, you know, 2.5 weeks after this policy took effect, on a whim, I just decided to create a change.org petition to basically, you know, undo the homeless camping policy. I didn't put, even to this day, we haven't put 1 cent of paid advertising behind it. It's been entirely organic, entirely grassroots driven. I really didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if it was, you know, going to have a few thousand people and that would be it. I mean, it took off in an unbelievable way. And as, you know, as we talked this week, we just surpassed 30,000 signatures. You know, what I wanted to do with the petition was give people an easy way to demonstrate their opposition to this policy. What we've also done, though, is we've created an army of people that are following this closely, that I'm updating on a, you know, 2 to 3 times a week basis. And they're taking action. You know, we've sent almost 1,000 emails to the council and another 1,000 emails to the mayor at this point. You know, these people are going to, you know, town hall meetings with council members. They've gone to, you know, forums across the city. There were 1,000 people at the convention center a couple weeks ago at a forum with the mayor and council member Greg Saar, who's the really, really far left council member who was behind this.
Like a communist, yeah.
Yeah. If we just kind of flash forward about where this is headed, I think they have an opportunity at the September 19th council meeting, which is the next council meeting, to change the policy. My hope is that we can put enough pressure on them that they undo it. That probably won't happen. But what I think they're going to do is they're going to basically say, okay, on high pedestrian areas, particular streets, we're going to not allow homeless camping. So 6th Street, Congress Avenue, Guadalupe on the edge of campus, you know, those kinds of streets, they're going to prevent it. Now, the problem with that is, you know, the homeless people that are camping on those streets are going to move 1 street over, right?
Right.
So it's going to make 5th Street more dangerous. And it's going to make, you know, these side streets more dangerous. But second of all is if homeless camping is not a threat to public safety, which the mayor and unfortunately the police chief have both said, then why are they banning it on particular streets? I mean, it undermines their own position.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I have said is if we do not win this battle on September 19th, we are going to move forward with a ballot proposition. We have missed the window for this November, so the next opportunity is next May. And that's obviously a ways off, and that's not as soon as I'd like. But we have to go out and collect 20,000 hard paper signatures to do that. And so we will be launching.
To me, I mean, there's obviously opportunities with ballot measures. But to me, I look at this and I see an issue where you could see a significant portion of city council thrown out of office over this. And that's a great
point
as well.
It's a great point, and honestly, it puts us in between, you know, two worthy goals, right? I absolutely believe we need massive change on the city council, and our mayor was just reelected, so he's not up until 3 years from now, and he's, I think, not going to run again. So only half the council is up in November of 2020, but you're right. I mean, this was an 9-2 vote. You had 2 council members vote against it. You know, the rest voted for it, and, of course, the mayor, you know, voting with them. 8 council members voting for it and the mayor. So you're right. It is a political issue, and there's I've lived in Austin since 1984. I have not seen an issue with greater intensity, and urgency, and anger and frustration from a broader perspective.
It's just a clear case of politicians playing to, I don't know, radical left activists and totally ignoring even Democrat voters. You know, just regular folks, even if they are of a liberal persuasion, just completely ignoring what they're telling him, what they're hearing. Now, we're running out of time, but before we finish, tell folks who are listening, who are interested in this issue, want to get more involved, want to sign the petition, how can they connect with you and get involved in that?
Absolutely. Thanks for asking. So the petition itself is available at SaveAustinNowPetition.com, which just redirects you to the change.org page, SaveAustinNowPetition.com. I am in the process right now of setting up a nonprofit organization with a local Democrat, a nonpartisan group called Save Austin Now, which will be the entity that collects the petition signatures. We do have a website, SaveAustinNow.com, where you can sign up for emails and kind of see updates and see news stories and things like that. So we're going to keep fighting. I mean, this is a battle worth winning. I imagine we have 90% public support for our position, and ultimately we will either win at the ballot box with the ballot petition, or we will convince the mayor and the city council to do the right thing. But we have to keep the pressure up.
Yeah, well, it's a good example of how to fight back. Appreciate what you organize and all that and what you're doing, and thanks for joining us and talking about it.
Thanks so much, Tony.
Hi, this is Kerry Cheshire with Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Your state lawmaker probably campaigned as a conservative, as someone who would go to Austin to cut spending and limit government. But did he keep that promise? At index.empowertexans.com, you can see how your lawmaker voted on the major issues of the legislative session. Things like property tax relief, the state budget, and regulatory reform. You can also view his score on the Fiscal Responsibility Index and decide if he needs a pat on the back, a wag of the finger, or perhaps a permanent vacation from public service. The Fiscal Responsibility Index is the premier tool for taxpayers to hold their lawmakers accountable. Check us out today at index.empowertexans.com.
Well, as we approach the end of this week's show, Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan shares some thoughts inspired by a place some think connected to the end of the world. He'll explain more in this week's commentary.
Hi, this is Michael Quinn Sullivan with this week's Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary. A little over a year ago, I made my first visit to Tel Megiddo in northern Israel. It's an ancient city sitting at the natural crossroads of the ancient world. As one long enamored with archaeology, I could have stayed for days, and I can't wait to return on our Empower Texans 2020 trip. Megiddo was of critical trade and strategic importance for seven millennia. Anyone traveling north and south through the region would pass near. Never heard of it? Yes, you have. You know of Megiddo by its Greek name through the writings of John in the New Testament book of Revelation, Armageddon. No matter what one thinks of eschatology and biblical prophecy, Megiddo tells us a lot about the opportunities we have if we seize them. The city was occupied for some 7,000 years. As an archaeological site, it's without equal. Layer upon layer of cities testify to people taking advantage of their geography to influence the world. Megiddo was in a valley that made for easy travel. One could literally touch the corners of the world merely by living in Megiddo. All the important roads came through Megiddo, and those who lived there drew immense power from controlling that junction. We all have such opportunities. Each of us is placed somewhere in which we interact directly or indirectly with thousands of people. Where are you? Are you using your position? Maybe it's your actual geographic location, or maybe it's your profession, skills, wealth, interests, or relationships to influence the world around you. Politically, grassroots conservatives are frustrated with the Doolittle legislative session. Texas lawmakers had the opportunity to lead the nation on critical reforms in 2019. Texas is at the center of attention with a critical opportunity to lead, yet they took a pass. As it happens, Megiddo's importance eventually waned. The geopolitical reality of the Iron Age, the rise of the Roman Empire, all washed by, and Megiddo fell away into rubble. It was uninhabited by around 500 BC, yet its name and legacy lived on as a literary tool and a rhetorical device. Megiddo's place in future history, of course, is an entirely different discussion. I choose not to believe Texas is entering a period of decline. I believe rejuvenation is possible. I know it's needed. You and I must decide what we will do to make Texas count and ensure the Lone Star State continues as a force for good influencing the world. Should the Lord tarry another 7,000 years, will Texas be remembered for squandering its place or seizing opportunities? What you and I do next will be the answer to that question. I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan, and this has been a Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary.
Re- recently I was looking at the reviews on the Texas Scorecard Radio podcast, and I wanted to thank all of you who've left a nice review and a five-star rating. If you haven't done that and you enjoy the program, go on there and do that for us. Leave a nice review and a five-star rating. That helps other people find the show. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.